From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! When Lauren Bacall tells Matt Lauer on NBC's Today program about a good friend who'd gone blind from an eye disease, urging the audience to see their doctors to be tested before it, and talks about a drug that might help out, is she just telling a heartfelt story, or is she paid by a drug company to advertise their product? Well, today, CNN says it will now reveal when its guests are being paid by drug companies. Jeb Bush's new child welfare head believes in spanking that causes welts and says women should consider work outside the home as bondage. And today is the 75th anniversary of the execution of anarchists Sacco and Vanzetti. We'll speak with author Howard Fast. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A federal secret intelligence court has determined the FBI lied or misled the court at least 75 times in an attempt to justify an expansion of FBI surveillance powers. The determination came in a ruling by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court in May. Congress made the ruling public yesterday. The secret court was formed 23 years ago to oversee Justice Department surveillance operations. This is only the second time the court has ever rejected an FBI request. The FBI was seeking approval for counterintelligence agents to freely share information gathered from wiretaps with criminal prosecutors. The court ruled the FBI had not taken the necessary steps to safeguard personal privacy. Most of the complaints date from the Clinton administration when the FBI was under the leadership of Louis Freeh. The court even found Freeh himself lied to the court. The Justice Department announced it would appeal the ruling. President Bush told reporters that Pakistani military ruler Pervez Musharraf is, quote, still tight with us on the war against terror, and that's what I appreciate, he said. Bush vowed to work with allies to promote democracy. Bush's comments came in response to a question about the Pakistani military leader's announcement earlier this week. He's giving himself the power to dissolve the elected parliament and appoint military leaders and Supreme Court justices. Musharraf also extended his stay in office by another 5 years. Bush's comments come 2 days before Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage was supposed to visit Islamabad and tell Pakistan the U.S. is concerned about Musharraf's power grabbing. The British government's tightening the controls on arms exports to Israel because of the Israeli military's tactics in the occupied territories. This, according to the British government, a letter to the British embassy in Tel Aviv, which was leaked to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Both the British and Israeli governments are publicly denying an embargo is in place. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has postponed his trip to Florida in September. He was scheduled to appear with Florida Governor Jeb Bush on the day before the Democratic primary to select a challenger to Jeb Bush. Sharon's office claims that the cancellation has nothing to do with protests from Florida Democrats. Mazen Al Nagar was deported Thursday to an undisclosed Middle Eastern country, ending his 7-year battle to remain in the United States. U.S. authorities claim that the Palestinian has terrorist ties, but he was never charged with any crime. Although Al Nagar spent more than 3 years in prison on secret evidence, he was released in 2000, arrested again after September 11th. His brother-in-law, Sami Al-Aryan, is a Palestinian computer science professor at the University of South Florida, which is trying to fire him. Association of University Professors is backing him. Meanwhile, the United States asked a UN panel on Thursday to remove 6 people and businesses from a sanctions list of those being punished for alleged ties to Al-Qaeda. The move follows sharp criticism from European nations and Canada about Washington's lack of evidence. Riot police used pepper spray and struck demonstrators with batons after ordering hundreds of people to leave a protest near a hotel in Oregon where George Bush was attending a fundraiser. Many of the protesters criticized Bush's new logging rules that'll make it easier for timber companies to cut wood in national forests. One veteran of the Vietnam War criticized Bush's anti-Iraq rhetoric, telling the London Guardian, "I don't think any American boys' lives are worth a barrel of oil." A USA Today CNN Gallup poll has found that almost half of Americans are against sending U.S. troops to Iraq. In November, only a quarter of Americans objected to sending troops. Meanwhile, former Republican Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger said he's not convinced the time is right for military action against Iraq, while Madeleine Albright, who held the job until last year, said Iraq is not a direct threat to the United States. And British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw broke with President Bush on Thursday, telling the BBC the best way to isolate and reduce Iraq's threat is to reintroduce weapons inspections. Kurdish intelligence officials are claiming a radical armed Islamic group with ties to Iran and Iraq has helped al-Qaeda establish an international terrorist training camp in northern Iraq. Washington hawks arguing for an invasion of Iraq have seized on the allegations, and earlier this week, the Bush administration was contemplating a covert strike on the territory. But according to the London Guardian, analysts decided that whatever al-Qaeda was up to was too rudimentary to pose a direct threat and was not worth risking American lives for. Meanwhile, senior Iraqi military officers in exile have opened centers to encourage 200,000 former soldiers to take up arms against Saddam Hussein. China has declared a state of emergency and is mobilizing more than a million people to combat surging floodwaters around Dongting Lake and surrounding rivers. Up to 10 million people could be engulfed if Dongting spills over into one of China's most densely populated regions. More than 600,000 people have already fled their homes. Meanwhile, a landslide triggered by heavy monsoon rain swept through a mountain village in eastern Nepal, killing up to 65 people and pushing the death toll from floods in South Asia to more than 1,000. Another 45 people are missing after a bus plunged into a river. In India, at least 75 people are missing after a 125-year-old dam burst under the pressure of the rains. And the World Bank is warning a fourfold increase in the size of the world economy over the next 50 years will come at the expense of water shortages, rising pollution, dysfunctional cities, and growing civic unrest unless international leaders take urgent action at next week's World Summit on Sustainable Development. Fears that the 10-day summit will be just talk and no action have been heightened in recent days by George Bush's decision not to attend.
Well, enough said about that. Still gotta get up in the morning. Well, enough said about that. Still gotta get up in the morning.
Still gotta get up. Oh, still gotta get up. You may be blue, feeling so bad. Gonna pull the colors up over your head. Well, enough said about that.
Still gotta get up in the morning.
Feet on the floor, put on your clothes, get yourself out the door. Well, enough said about that.
Still gotta get up in the morning.
Well, enough said about that.
Still gotta get up in the morning.
Still. Oh, oh. Still. Got to go outside, walk down the street. Gonna try to be decent. Teach so you need.
Still got to get up in the morning, sweet honey in the rock. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to our listeners around the country. Amy, there was an interesting article in the Miami Herald a few days ago. Didn't get much attention, but apparently the Swiss banks have returned to Peru $77 million that was in secret accounts of Vladimir Montesino, the old spy chief of Peru, who's now in jail. On money laundering, drug running, arms smuggling charges, and apparently this was part of the proceeds of his second job, his moonlighting job as spy chief. And there's another $30 million that are still being argued about between the Swiss banks and Peru. But of course, we know that Montesinos was on the CIA payroll while he was running drugs and smuggling arms involved in his various other illicit activities. And Fujimori, of course, is still on the lam in Japan, we'll see what happens with him. But another favorite of the United States has had his reputation sullied once out of office.
And I'm sure there will be more documents that eventually get declassified talking about the U.S. support for the Montesinos Fujimori regime, just as documents have now come out. Thousands of pages have come out around U.S. involvement with the Argentine generals during the Dirty War of the 1970s in Argentina. Today we're going to take a look here at home. There was an interesting piece a couple of weeks ago in the New York Times. It was the front page of the money and business section of the Sunday Times. It was a piece by Melody Peterson, and it began, "In a rare interview, Lauren Bacall appeared on the NBC Today program in March, telling Matt Lauer about a good friend who'd gone blind from an eye disease and urging the audience to see their doctors to be tested for it. It's just frightening. It's frightening because it can happen very suddenly," she said. Ms. Bacall then mentioned a drug called Visudyne, a new treatment for the disease known as macular degeneration. She never revealed that she was being paid to tell the story, and neither did the network NBC. And then it quotes a representative of Novartis, the Swiss drug maker that sells Visudyne. "Novartis chose Bacall for its marketing campaign," the spokesperson said, "because she appeals to many people over 50, the primary market for the drug." And the spokesperson said, "Yes, we compensated her at the time." The person said, "We realized people would accept that what she was telling them." Very interesting piece. So Lauren Bacall didn't say she was being paid, and NBC knew she was being paid, but also didn't let the listeners know. Well, the New York Times is reporting today that CNN will begin to reveal any connections between guests and pharmaceutical companies. The announcement comes after the revelations that a growing number of Hollywood celebrities are appearing on TV talk shows to talk about medical issues while being bankrolled by major pharmaceutical firms. The list of who's on the payroll of drug companies is impressive. Lauren Bacall, Kathleen Turner, Rob Lowe, Danny Glover, talk show host Larry King, Montel Williams, figure skater Peggy Fleming. All these celebrities have appeared on top-rated shows to discuss medical problems and often directly recommend a drug. The question is, when do the viewers or listeners know that they are being paid? In some cases, they do say. But in some cases, they don't. According to the Wall Street Journal, actor Rob Lowe fetched upwards of $1 million for his role in a so-called public education campaign about treating infections caused by chemotherapy. The money was coming from Amgen, the pharmaceutical firm that manufactures the drug Neulasta, which cures the problem. On April 22nd, he appeared on Entertainment Tonight and the Rosie O'Donnell Show to discuss how his dad, Chuck Lowe, suffered from the ailment. Public health officials have expressed grave concern for years with the ambitious promotional campaigns of drug companies. But the Food and Drug Administration says everything that firms like Amgen and Pfizer are doing is legal. The FDA has long been accused of being sympathetic to the drug firms it regulates. Earlier this week, the agency asked a federal judge in Los Angeles to overturn a ruling that would have barred certain TV ads for the drug Paxil. The judge had ruled drug manufacturer GlaxoSmithKline misled consumers by saying Paxil is not habit-forming. Some 35 patients said they suffered withdrawal symptoms such as nausea, fever, electric zaps to their bodies. The plaintiff's attorney told the Associated Press, "The fact that the FDA is now trying to step in and advocate on the side of the pharmaceutical company is disgusting to me." Well, we're joined right now by two people who've been following this: Sidney Wolfe, director of Public Citizens Health Research Group, and Gary Ruskin, executive director of Commercial Alert. Gary, let's begin with you. What about this promotion?
Well, increasingly, Hollywood is inserting itself into the process of drug marketing. There's been this Lauren Bacall thing where she flagged for Novartis's Visudyne the Today Show without disclosing that she's a paid agent of Novartis. Montel Williams did a whole show on multiple sclerosis. He promoted a drug called Copaxone by name, but didn't disclose his financial ties to Teva Pharmaceuticals, which makes Copaxone. This is very deceptive. People need to know who is a shill and who is not a shill to be able to understand where this information is coming from. There are many problems when drug marketers hire celebrities, and then the celebrities do not disclose that the information that they are giving to the public via TV or radio is actually a part of a paid promotional campaign. People end up taking more drugs or more dangerous drugs or less effective drugs, which leads to excess deaths and injuries. And then there are the more general problems of direct-to-consumer drug marketing, which is the higher taxpayer cost of pumping up demand for expensive drugs, and the ads raise the price of drugs.
Well, how is it that the FDA, even with its poor rules or laws on consumer protection, does have a requirement that when promoting a drug on television, you must mention the side effects potentially that people may be exposed to, but yet these celebrities, when they get on these talk shows or these interviews, don't necessarily do that?
Well, essentially there's a loophole in the rule, and it's important to understand that the loophole and the whole policy debate on drug marketing occurs against the backdrop of very heavy soft money campaign contributions, especially to Republicans who want to keep the drug marketing system the way it is. I should just mention, for example, Bristol-Myers Squibb gave, during this election cycle, nearly $1 million to Republicans, $135,000 to Democrats, Eli Lilly, another major drug manufacturer, $760,000 to Republicans, $110,000 to Democrats, Pfizer, $700,000 to Republicans, $138,000 to Democrats in soft money. And so this is the context through which this policy debate occurs in Washington.
We wanted to take a listen on for radio viewers and take a look for our video viewers to a short promotional clip produced by the drug manufacturer Amgen, which features Rob Lowe and his father Chuck Lowe. It was released via Newsstream, which markets promotional videos as news segments to local TV stations. And then we'd like to get Sid Wolf's response. Again, this is Rob Lowe and his father Chuck Lowe.
By his father's side during his struggle against cancer. It was a difficult time for both of them.
As a family, we knew that my dad's chemotherapy could cause him to lose his hair or have nausea, but we had no idea that chemotherapy could cause an infection and that it could delay his treatment and his time in remission.
By destroying white blood cells along with cancer cells, chemotherapy can make patients vulnerable to infections. Infections are one of the most serious and unrecognized consequences of chemotherapy. Even simple infections can land patients in the hospital, put life-saving treatment on hold, and become life-threatening. To raise awareness about infection risk, Rob is launching a new public education initiative called By My Side, Taking Charge of Cancer Treatment.
By My Side gives cancer patients and their families the power to take charge of their treatment and avoid roadblocks like infections.
Rob is working with biotechnology company Amgen, makers of a new prescription medicine called Neulasta that can help protect chemotherapy patients from infections.
Close to 40% of chemotherapy patients.
You've been listening to paid advertisement, Rob Lowe and his father, Chuck Lowe. Now, this is clear that they're doing an advertisement here, which is quite different from a news interview. We once had Danny Glover on our local show at WBAI, who was also talking about a drug, but he was there with the representative. It was very clear that he was a part of this campaign. Sid Wolf, is there something wrong if the actor lets you know?
Well, I think the issue is selling drugs by whatever means, official advertising or what used to be called infomercials, which are things that appear to be news but are really commercials. I think the problem, I mean, Gary's being a little too kind to the Democrats in that back in around 1997, the FDA greatly reduced their enforcement over prescription drug advertising. The FDA is able to send a letter to a company who puts out an ad that overstates the benefits or understates the risk and say, stop this ad because it is illegal. And they were doing that at a reasonable clip until about 1997. Since then, there's been about a 50% decrease, that if just for regular advertisements for which there is regulatory authority, the FDA has fallen way down, and companies are able to get away with ads that really can kill or injure people. If an ad upon which a doctor or patient bases a decision to use a drug overstates the benefits and understates the risk, then a patient may get a prescription for something that is needlessly more dangerous or less effective than another drug. So the point is that FDA at least has the authority but hasn't been enforcing advertisement. Now we switch gears from the Bob Dole selling Viagra, which is an ad. It's a well-known person being well-paid to push Viagra out to the public. Whatever that ad says, if it overstates the benefits, understates the risk, the FDA can stop it. Now we're in the sphere, which is what the main topic of our conversation now is, of infomercials or non-ads. And the FDA really cannot do very much about it. I think one of the things that the media can do, as CNN has announced, is at least ask anyone who's going to talk about a product whether they're getting paid and tell people about that. Other parts of the media might decide that they don't want to use their news time as a shill for what is really advertising. But the public is very vulnerable, and I'm including physicians, not just patients. Most advertising money is still going to physicians. Close to half of these ads have misleading information. And there's a Canadian economist who wrote this wonderful book called The Garden of Folly, talking about advertising. The book was 78 years ago, I believe, and he described advertising as the science of arresting the human intelligence long enough to make money from it. And that's pretty still much the definition of advertising I would go with. And using a well-known celebrity to sort of break down the barriers that someone might otherwise have towards receiving some information works, whether it's in a regular real ad or in one of these infomercials.
But so Sidney Wolf, can I interrupt you for 1 second and ask you, this whole issue of celebrities being utilized in this way, clearly we're a celebrity-driven society now in terms of much of our news coverage. Could this possibly backfire? Is it conceivable that some viewer, convinced by Rob Lowe to try to urge his doctor to give him the particular medicine, might end up suing these celebrities because of side effects that they experience from the drug?
I don't know that, but certainly I would bet that a number of the celebrities themselves have not been fully informed about the benefits and risks of these drugs that they're pushing. I mean, all drugs have adverse effects. And if they're being used for treating a life-threatening disease, it may make sense to take the chance of getting the adverse effect. But I think your point is well taken. The backfire might come when, for example, some well-known celebrity helped to push a drug that turned out to be dangerous. The company knew it was dangerous, which we've had a number of instances of, didn't tell the public and didn't tell the celebrity. So the celebrity has essentially been hung out to dry and has been used to do something, sell drugs that may have resulted in a number of deaths and injuries.
Sid Wolf, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. We're going to come back to this in a minute. We're talking with Sidney Wolf, who is head of the Health Research Group in Washington, D.C., and Gary Ruskin, who is executive director of Commercial Alert. Later in the program, author Howard Fast will be talking about the 75th anniversary of the execution of Sacco and Vanzetti. And we're going to look at Jeb Bush's new child welfare head. Does he endorse spanking that causes bruises and welts? Stay with us.
Goodbye to you, my brave comrades. Goodbye to you, Swatzel Slane. Goodbye to North Plymouth. Goodbye, Boston Harbor. I'll never see you again. Well, our jury, God help us, what chance did we have when the cruel judge called us low breed? He was heard to declare they should get the chair. They're reds, and what more do you need?
Well, a dog that kills chickens you wouldn't convict on the evidence, judge, that you've heard. But you'll show no concern when these two witches burn for preaching the dangerous word.
Goodbye to you, my brave comrade.
Goodbye to you, Swastle slain. Goodbye to North Plymouth. Goodbye, Boston Harbor. I'll never see you again.
Charlie King, Karen Brandow from the new album Remembering Sacco and Vanzetti. You are listening to Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests are Sid Wolf, who is a doctor and head of Health Research Group in Washington, D.C., and Gary Ruskin, executive director of Commercial Alert, as we talk about the increasing number of, well, they're not actually called commercials. They're news interviews like on programs like The Today Show, where Matt Lauer interviewed Lauren Bacall. She talked about a heartfelt story of her friend who had suffered from macular degeneration, named a drug, and it turns out she was on the payroll of the drug company that made it. By the way, we called Lauren Bacall last night, left a message, but didn't get a response back from her. Sid Wolf, on the issue of if you name a drug company, even in these so-called news interviews, the FDA is saying you have to give out an 800 number and list the side effects. It doesn't apply here?
That's for television ads. I mean, for print ads, you have to give all the side effects. It's adverse effects. Side effects is sort of a drug industry word. Adverse effects is a more accurate description of something unwanted that you get with the alleged benefit of the drug. So if it is a print ad, you have to have right in the ad the benefits, the risks, the warnings, and so forth. And starting in August of 1997, just about 5 years ago, the FDA lifted the lid on the requirement for TV ads to put these warnings, and instead said you can give an 800 number out or website or whatever else. And unfortunately, most of the people, we would guess from some studies that have been done, don't really go there. So they get more about the benefits from the visuals and print in the TV ad, and they don't get that much about the risk. But again, that's an advertisement. And what we were talking about before is that there's a line currently vague, I believe, between infomercials, these things that appear to be news but are really commercials, and real advertisements. And I think that this issue needs to be addressed. I believe that once someone is paid by a company to promote something, that in many ways, if not always, constitutes advertising and should be subject to the strictures of advertising. But as I mentioned before, even real clear ads are not being enforced as much as before. So the FDA needs a little more law and order, and it's needed it for about 5 or 6 years now in terms of enforcing advertising regulations.
But even in this whole issue of just the general advertising, what has been the impact on doctors who suddenly are confronted with, for instance, I watch CBS Evening News from time to time. 3/4 of the ads on the CBS Evening News, because that's the network that older Americans watch, are all drug ads. Ask your doctor about this drug. Ask your doctor about that drug. What's the impact on the doctors of suddenly being confronted by their patients who are being brainwashed by these drug ads to begin requesting particular drugs?
Well, in a word or two words, it works. I mean, there are a number of studies. The FDA did one recently showing that a significant enough proportion of those people who watch the ads go to their doctor, say, hey, what about this? Looks like it's the best thing since sliced aspirin or something. And often enough, the doctor yields and goes for it. Of course, the doctors themselves are also misled, A, by watching the same ads on television, but by receiving in their medical journals and elsewhere a lot of misleading advertisements. Some doctors resent it because they realize that the patients are often grossly misled, over-enthusiastic about something that really isn't much different than something else that's been around for a longer time. I think that this industry, the drug industry, is very, very desperate. In a front page story 2 years and a month ago in the Wall Street Journal, Gardner Harris basically said they're running out of new ideas and new drugs in their pipeline, and so they're investing their money in advertising and promotion. And celebrity advertising and promotion is one example. Most, not all, but most of the ads that are the most heavily advertised are ones that are not distinguishable in terms of safety or effectiveness from a number of other older drugs that we know more about that are often generically available and less expensive.
Well, let me ask Gary Ruskin, your head of commercial alert. There's a whole new trend. I was reading about it in Advertising Age about the spotless hour, where you no longer would break away for a 60-second commercial because people understand you might go to the refrigerator then. But instead, you have product placement, right? The products are put into the hour sitcom, and so you're much more sort of influenced by that, being like the actors and using what they use. And also, the products get woven into the storyline of the hour. Isn't this when you have people like Lauren Bacall talking in her news interviews, you know, about some drug? Isn't this more the wave of the future?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, what is happening here is that advertising agencies are discovering that there's a backlash against advertising generally in the United States, and so there's a decline in the effectiveness of the 30-second spot. And so drug companies and other companies are looking for ways to integrate their advertising messages into editorial and entertainment content because it catches people off guard, and people are more receptive to advertising there on TV and in movies. And so we're seeing a shift of advertising content into editorial and entertainment content, and that will increase until we have new rules and laws to require that it be disclosed.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Gary Ruskin, Executive Director of Commercial Alert, and Sydney Wolf, Director of Public Citizens Health Research Group in Washington, D.C. Florida Governor Jeb Bush last week tried to squash a potential threat to his reelection campaign by immediately naming a new head to the state's scandal-ridden child welfare agency. Bush appointed Jerry Regier to lead the agency less than 48 hours after Kathleen Kearney resigned. Under Kearney's leadership, the agency admitted it lost 4-year-old Rhea Wilson without noticing for more than a year. Hours after Bush made the surprise appointment, reporters at the Miami Herald typed Regier's name into the popular web search engine Google. They discovered Regier had co-authored an essay in 1989 published by the California-based Coalition on Revival called The Christian Worldview of the Family. In it, Regier writes that spanking, which causes bruises or welts, is acceptable punishment. Among some of the essay's additional highlights, women should work outside the home only if the family is in a financial crisis and should consider the work bondage. Quote, the radical feminist movement has damaged the morale of many women and convinced men to relinquish their biblical authority in the home. Gay men and lesbians shouldn't be parents. Christians shouldn't marry non-Christians. Divorce is acceptable only when there's adultery or desertion, and abortion is wrong. Regier also, in this essay that apparently he co-authored, urges Christians to take, quote, whatever actions we can within our biblical and constitutional limits to realign county, state, and federal legislation regarding family issues in order to make it conform to the Bible's view of reality and morality. Florida Governor Jeb Bush's spokesperson claimed the governor wasn't aware of Regier's writings before the appointment, and Regier himself claims he didn't write the essay. He says his name was on the front cover of the essay because he was the co-chair of the committee that wrote the essay. We're joined right now by two people, Karen Gevers, who's president of Children's Advocacy Foundation in Florida. Her organization is suing Florida's Child Welfare Agency, and B.J. Medley, director of Oklahoma NARAL. That's National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League. Let's begin with B.J. Medley. Can you tell us about Regier's background? He comes from Oklahoma.
Yes, he does. He's very conservative, obviously, by many of the things you've already said. He has been involved in the marriage initiative as well as, of course, abstinence teaching in all the schools here, along with working in the health department and trying to clean it up, quote unquote.
And by the marriage initiative, what do you mean?
Well, Oklahoma wanted to pass a law that said that basically forcing especially the poorer people to push for marriage when they have children. And in that process, of course, some could be positive. It's certainly not that we don't believe in a father-mother family. But what was happening is in our concerns of if this had totally passed through the legislature, was the fact that there might be a lot more abuse on a woman if she was, you know, pushed into marrying. And the option was that they might even lose money by marrying due to the fact that they had children and they were on welfare.
And Mr. Regier, was he also involved in something called the Character First program?
Well, I'm not sure if that was the exact title, but Keating, ever since Keating's been in and he's brought in a lot of the conservatives with him, we've seen a continual initiatives of that. An example is on the abstinence situation that they are, of course, pushing nationally, but James Dobson's group here in Oklahoma got the largest grant. That will give you an idea of what they're focused on.
And didn't Regier co-found the Family Research Council, which is well-known, headed by Gary Bauer?
Correct. And like you say, in regards to him stating that he, you know, had his name on the front of a paper that obviously, you know, accepted abuse of children, even though he didn't read it, that right there would make me wonder why he should have a head of any agency.
Well, let's talk about the agency he's going to head in Florida. Karen Gevers is president of the Children's Advocacy Foundation. You're suing Florida's Child Welfare Agency. Why?
For years, the system has been in a state of meltdown. Preceding Governor Jeb Bush has taken over, there have been problems. But under the Bush administration, we've seen the situation for children who have been taken from their families become less and less safe, and children spend way too long in foster care, many times serving only to enrich the contract providers in whose care they have been physically placed. There has been no support of the frontline workers from Governor Bush. At the present time, there are more than 750 frontline vacancies for investigators and caseworkers. The state has embarrassingly lost children, such as came to light with the story of little Willia Wilson earlier this year. There are over 500 children that have been reported as missing, and yet the Department of Children and Families has not been looking for them. The belief is that that's because they haven't generated enough foster care placements for these children. The placements we have, many of them are overcrowded, and in many of them, children are sexually abused and physically abused. Then when they, quote, act out, they are put on very powerful mind-altering medications because it's easier for the caretakers. It's just a horrendous system of abuse, and it's supposed to be there for children who themselves have already been abused and neglected. It is both criminal and sinful the way the Florida system has been run.
And how has Jeb Bush been able to have this occur under his leadership? But apparently the word has not gotten out nationwide on this at all, and he seems to still be having a pretty good chance of being reelected.
Well, the reelection campaign, of course, there's quite a bit of money that comes in, and money buys TV advertising. But the system and the flaws in the system, the problems with the system that have been hurting children, were known to Jeb before he took over. In fact, that was one of his campaign promises, that he would fix the system. When he took over, though, what he decided to do was to put all of the focus on coming up with a very expensive, cumbersome computer system, which was supposed to cost no more than $30 million, is now already cost close to $250 million. It still isn't working. The other part of the initiative...
Was that computer system by the same company that did the computer work on the felons and the voting in the election?
You know, I don't know if there was some involvement there, but I know they keep redesigning it in-house, like with a committee, and it's been one of the big holes into which they're pouring money with no apparent benefit to children. And then the privatization effort that he has been pushing, there has been done in a way that there is no accountability. It's like the privatization focus was where he was looking, and he didn't care what was happening to the children under state protection at the time, and there's close to 45,000 children that the state has taken from their homes and therefore is responsible for, and those children have been seemingly uncared about by Governor Bush until the story of Aurelia Wilson broke. Right now, there are more than 1,800 contracts that have been given to private providers to a tune of more than $3 billion, with a B, dollars, and yet there's not one person in the department or anywhere in Florida's government whose job it is to make sure those dollars help the children in any way.
Are these issues at all prominent in the gubernatorial race?
You know, I'm very happy to say that they are. They're becoming one of the top issues in the gubernatorial race. But the sad thing is that the rhetoric is not helping the children who are there right now being abused, at risk of being abused, stuck in a system that they did nothing wrong to get into. They were just believed to be at risk of being abused or neglected. It's just tragic that the children have gotten the very short end of the stick. And if you're looking for the biggest child exploiter and abuser in the country, I'm afraid to have to say that it's probably Florida's foster care system.
Is there a danger now that in the state's attempt to find the 500 or so or the hundreds of missing children, I'm sure many of them have basically run away and gone to live with relatives, that there will be a crackdown in essence again on minority communities, because many of these children are from minority communities, to sort of a dragnet now launched by the state?
There is that concern, especially when the fact that children run away from foster placements usually means the child doesn't feel safe in that foster placement. And, of course, the majority of children that the state has put into foster care, Florida's population is approximately 18% black. More than 50% of the children in the system are black. And black children, you know, they track all the statistics. It takes the department longer to move their cases forward or find these children permanent homes or return them to their own families. So it is an insidious discrimination that has been going on for years and has gotten worse under this administration.
What about the issue of gay and lesbian adoptions in Florida and where he would fit into this? So Rosie O'Donnell has taken a very high profile on this issue as she came out and had an extensive interview with Diane Sawyer about being a lesbian and also on the issue of a lesbian adopting children in Florida.
Florida's laws are so messed up on this subject. It is perfectly fine under Florida's laws for any person with no criminal background to serve as a foster parent. It's only if the foster parent who has bonded to a child and decides to adopt that child, thereby making permanent the child's home, faces scrutiny into sexual beliefs or practices. And it makes no sense. We do not have enough good foster parents. We do not have enough good adoptive parents. There are more than 3,000 children waiting for adoptive parents right now. While they are waiting, these children are being kept, in many of them, in overcrowded places, some where they're being abused. Some of the children have so given up hope that they've been locked in psychiatric hospitals because of the shortage of good adoptive parents. I just wish that the people who feel so strongly on this issue would step up to the plate and offer to adopt these children whose parental rights have been terminated, and these children have no one to go to bat for them.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Karen Gievers, president of Children's Advocacy Foundation in Florida. Her organization is suing Florida's Child Welfare Agency. And B.J. Medley, director of Oklahoma NARAL, the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll talk to author Howard Fast. He wrote the book on Sacco and Vanzetti. Today is the 75th anniversary of their execution. Stay with us.
If nothing happens, they will electrocute us right after midnight. Therefore, here I am, right with you, with love and with open heart, as I was
yesterday. Don't cry, Dante, for many, many tears have been wasted, just as your mother's tears have been already wasted for 7 years and never did any good. So, son, instead of crying, be strong, be brave, so as to be able to comfort your mother. And when you want to distract her from the discouraging soulness, you take her for a long walk in the quiet countryside, gathering flowers here and there, and resting under the shade of trees beside the music of the water, the peacefulness.
Sacco's letter to his son, Charlie King, and Karen Brandow are singing it. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. 75 years ago today, August 23rd, 1927, two Italian-American anarchists, Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti, were executed in Massachusetts. They were sentenced to death on charges of murder and robbery, but many historians consider the case to be the most unjust and politically charged murder case in U.S. history. To quote Emma Goldman, Sacco and Vanzetti died, as the entire world knows today, because they were anarchists. That is to say, because they believed and preached human brotherhood and freedom. As such, they could expect neither justice nor humanity. Emma Goldman went on to say, for the masters of life can forgive any offense or crime, but never an attempt to undermine their security on the backs of the masses. Therefore, Sacco and Vanzetti had to die, notwithstanding the protests of the entire world. Well, on this, the 75th anniversary, the protests continue. Activists around the world are commemorating the execution with public rallies and teach-ins. In New York, a four-hour memorial will be held in Union Square beginning at 5 p.m., as just an example. We're joined now by author Howard Fast. He wrote the book The Passion for Sacco and Vanzetti in 1953. Howard Fast has been on our program before when I had the chance to come out to his home in Connecticut with producer Jeremy Scahill. He's a prolific author of historical novels, biographies, popular histories, children's stories. He also ran for Congress himself in 1952 on the American Labor Party. In 1950, the House Committee on Un-American Activities ordered Fast to provide the names of all those who'd contributed to the support of a hospital for Spanish Republicans in Toulouse, France, with which he had been associated during the Spanish Civil War. When he refused, he was thrown in jail for months. Blacklisted upon his release, he initiated his own publishing company, the Blue Heron Press, just to list a few of his accomplishments. He joins us now. Howard Fast, welcome.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Could you tell, for some of our listeners who are not familiar with the Sacco and Vanzetti case, some of the outlines of it?
Well, you know, it was almost 100 years ago, and I was 6 years old at the time it happened, and my life was intertwined with these facts for many years afterwards. Today I am 88 years old, which makes me a living repository of history. And even though almost 100 years have passed, the New York Times op-ed page, Bob Herbert, has written four columns about a town in Texas where the tragedy of Sacco and Vanzetti is being reenacted now as I speak. We don't seem to learn, and we don't remember our own history. Sacco and Vanzetti is one of the best remembered cases of legal injustice in American history, but not the only one. We take the best of our people, the most concerned, the most passionate, and we put them to death. And after they are put to death, we ennoble them as heroes. This happened with John Brown, whose only effort was to free the slaves, and we hanged him, but then after we hanged him, we made him a hero, a martyr, and a saint. So this is what the world has done, and we have done to an extent with Sacco and Vanzetti. They were two working people. Sacco was a ordinary working man. Vanzetti was a fish peddler. They were pulled out of a situation with no evidence whatsoever, and a Massachusetts jury condemned them to death. And for 7 years, they sat on death row before this sentence was carried out. Go ahead now.
Let me ask you, the original alleged crime that they committed occurred in 1920, and that was really at a time when there were many Italian immigrants and many with radical views in the country, and suddenly there was an enormous political dragnet. I think it was Attorney General Palmer at the time. Could you see any parallels between what happened then and what's been happening in recent years now with our own government's war on terrorism and the dragnet that we are conducting, that our government is conducting against Muslims?
Yes. It happens over and over. We repeat our history. The thousands and thousands of Muslims who have immigrated to America come here with one desire, to live in peace and freedom, which, as we believe, is impossible in their homelands. We have made their lives a living hell. We have arrested them by the hundreds, without evidence, without cause. They remain in jail. They have no hearings. The act of habeas corpus, which is intrinsic to our history, is never exercised in their behalf, and so we do it again. But to me, the sin above all sin.
And how did this happen in the 20s? Could you give us, again, some of our listeners who are not familiar with that history,
who perhaps weren't around then?
Well, after World War I, which finished in 1918, there were hundreds of thousands of dispossessed people in Europe, and they turned toward America. And a thing began which historians remember as the Palmer Raids. Raids against these people, most often with no cause and no evidence, simply because they were immigrants. And in this case, Italians, who at that time in Boston were held in great disdain. The two of these victims were Sacco and Vanzetti. And yes, they sat in prison for 7 years before the death sentence was carried out.
I'm looking at a piece by the Associated Press about the 75 years later, how in Boston and the North End 75 years ago, thousands of people protested the execution The crime coming at the height of Italian immigration against a backdrop of other atrocities committed by anarchists, AP says, including a 1920 New York bombing that killed 40 people near Wall Street. According to some accounts, eyewitnesses were brought to jail where Sacco and Vanzetti were made to assume poses aping the movements the killers were seen to make. After the verdict, Judge Webster Thayer was quoted as saying, "Did you see what I did? Did you see what I did with those anarchist bastards the other day?" Sacco and Vanzetti sitting on death row for 7 years while their case became a cause célèbre internationally. Half a century later, former Governor Michael Dukakis took the unprecedented step of proclaiming the men did not receive a fair trial. Boston Public Library now is hosting an exhibit of crime scene photographs, and there are other events that are happening around the world. As we talk about today, from your 88-year-old perch, can you talk, Howard Fast, about your take on what's happening in this post-911 world, especially in the United States under George Bush?
Well, I could say a great deal about that, and I'm sure there's not time for it today, but I will say a few words. In my lifetime, I have seen our country put into the White House a man who, at best, one could call half-educated, a man whose popular vote was less than his opponents, and a man whose deciding vote that made him president in the state of Florida was determined not by the will of the people, but by the Supreme Court of the United States, perhaps the most vicious, unrepresentative Supreme Court in all our history. The Supreme Court put him in power in what other nations all over the world described as a putsch, which means an overthrow of a legally constituted government by a select power group. I have lived to see this. So for me, the case of Sacco and Vanzetti is not yesterday, but a continuing process. And if my listeners will only read Howard Zinn, that's Z-I-N-N, Howard Zinn's wonderful history of the American people, which is called A People's History, they will come to understand through reading this book that what happened to Sacco and Vanzetti happens again and again and again, and is happening at this moment to the black citizens of Texas and to the hundreds of thousands of honest, hardworking Muslims in this country.
Well, I want to thank you very much for spending this brief time with us. Howard Fast, author of so many books, among his most famous, The Immigrants, which was turned into a two-part television film that traced an American family from the turn of the century through the Vietnam War era. You can go back on our website at democracynow.org and spend an hour with Howard Fast when we went out to his home and talked with Howard about his life and his work. Again, a protest 75 years ago around the execution of Sacco and Vanzetti, and protests today as well. Thank you, Howard Fast. And that does it for the program. I'm looking forward to going out to Northern California this weekend. Tonight I'll be at the College of Marin with a Peace and Justice group there. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Jeremy Scahill, with help from Monica Lopez and Mike Burke. I want to thank Mike DeFilippo, who's filling in from Anthony Sloan. Our very best vibes go out to Anthony to heal. And thank you so much to Jolie Rickman, who is our music maestro standing in for Anthony. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Have a good weekend.
Who will remember the hand so white and fine that touched the finest linen, that poured the finest wine? Who will remember the genteel words they spoke to name the lives of two good men, a nuisance or a joke? All who know these two good arms know I never had to rob or kill. I can live by my own two hands and live well.